Welcome to Bioethics in the Margins. We are a group of bioethicists from different institutions across the country. This podcast represents our views and those of our guests, but we do not speak for our universities or medical centers, nor for any formalized bioethics organizations. Our mission is to bring marginalized topics and voices into the bioethics discourse. This podcast is hosted by Dr. Amelia Barwise, Associate Professor of Medicine and Assistant Professor of Biomedical Ethics at the Mayo Clinic, and Dr. Kirk Johnson, Assistant Professor of Justice Studies and Medical Humanities at Montclair State University. Please enjoy this conversation.
Welcome to another episode of Bioethics in the Margins. And today we have Lynette Martins with us as a guest. And Lynette is a 2022 graduate of the LLM in National and Global Health Law Program from the O'Neill Institute at Georgetown Law. And her interests lie in the intersectionality of law, health policy and ethics. In particular, she has an interest in social and behavioural interventions as they apply to health justice and equity. Most recently, Martins has been fascinated by health security in both the domestic and global context. Prior to enrolling at Georgetown Law, Martins worked as a teaching assistant in the Departments of Political Science and Medical Ethics and Health Policy at the University of Pennsylvania. She also worked as a research assistant in the Department of Business, Economic and Public Policy at the University's Wharton School. Finally, Martins served as a public health research officer and a neuroepidemiology researcher at Public Hospitals Authority in Nassau, Bahamas. Martin holds an MS in bioethics from the University of Pennsylvania, a postgraduate diploma in population health evidence from the University of Manchester, and a certificate in evidence-based medicine from Oxford University. Martins is also a Global Institute of Human Rights scholar at the University of Pennsylvania, and she's currently transitioning out of a fellowship at the Solomon Center for Health Law and Policy at Yale Law School and has been doing some consultancy work. So you're very welcome to Bioethics in the Margins, Lynette, and thank you so much for being here.
And thank you all.
So just very briefly before we get into, we invited you here to talk about medical-legal partnerships, but just before we get into that, can you just tell us about the National and Global Health Law Program, what it's designed to do, and sort of how this program differs from some more traditional masters and tracks for people who are interested in law and health policy?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me on this podcast. I'm a big fan of some of the topics that you have been covering and really excited to kind of dive into the ones we're going to be discussing today. So the National and Global Health Law LLM at Georgetown University Law Center through the O'Neill Institute, it's basically a one-year program. It can be extended if you're doing it part-time, but generally most people do it in 1 year. And so I think the benefit of this is it can help students really understand sort of the interaction between the two fields, so better equipping them to navigate both worlds really seamlessly. It's really designed also to help like health lawyers use both policy and legal tools to really effectuate and achieve health equity in a variety of situations. So unlike a traditional JD program, or I wouldn't say traditional, but sort of the ordinary law school program here in the United States, the LLM really gives students an understanding of laws that shape global health governance. And so usually the JD programs are 3 years, the LLMs are typically 1 year, postgraduate specialization, and a lot of times the prerequisite is to already have your first degree in law before you even attend the university because it is a specialized program. Programs such as like an MS in health policy would typically really center more on health services. And by that, I mean the delivery and sort of the economics behind health services delivery and how medical markets interact with healthcare delivery and maybe some of the research methods used to evaluate health services in that way. So I think there's a really marked difference between the two and also between sort of that, the JD program I would equate to an LLB in sort of like Europe and some parts of Canada and so on and so forth, other parts of the globe. So those would be more consistent. The master's, the LLM, is just basically giving you a super specialization in this area of health law that prepares you for not only sort of the domestic context. So for instance, in FDA law, if you want to work in that region, or the global health domain, which is what predominantly most candidates do.
Great. Well, thanks for outlining that for us. So I want to put a plug in for the ASBH Immigration Affinity Group, because that's where you and I met, Lynette, and we've had a few people on from that group. That group was established by Dr. Brian Toohey, who's going to be a guest with us in the fall. And he's a sociologist interested in immigration. And we've also had Dr. Koszewski on talking about nonprofit hospitals. And of course, he's a great interest in immigration. And we've had Dr. Rachel Fabi on. So lots of people from that group. Kind of, can you explain to us why, because you're one of the co-leaders of that group, can you sort of explain why you're interested in being involved and leading that?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I just want to build off of what you spoke about with the Affinity Group. I just want to say that it's been championed by really some pivotal people in bioethics. And I think Dr. Brian Toohey from Temple has spearheaded this initiative, which I think is fantastic. And so, you know, I really just wanted to carry out sort of the initial iteration of what I would say Mark Koszewski, Rachel Fabi, and Nancy Berlinger have really sort of championed all along and throughout, you know, the course of many years. And what's been wonderful is sort of hosting these monthly meetings where we get to sort of talk about a relevant and contemporary topic that's compelling us in overlapping and dealing with the areas of immigration and bioethics. And, you know, just what motivated me is just twofold. I think first, it's just a wonderful group of people to interact with, and they're just so collegial and inviting and warm and friendly. They have such unique and distinct perspectives, which I really love, being exposed to so many different viewpoints about this topic. But also, you know, from sort of a personal background, having, you know, being an immigrant myself and moving here, sort of growing up as a global citizen, you know, born in one country, raised in many others. And so kind of coming here with that perspective also and carrying along some of the stories and experiences that I might have experienced along the way, and sort of the dynamic that's surrounding immigration just in general has really kind of interested me for many years now. So I think I haven't ordinarily published in this space, so this is kind of a new area for me, but it's definitely something that I've been thinking about in my imagination, at least.
No, it's brilliant to have you there. So I kind of want to move on now to, you know, what we want to focus on today. So, you know, all our listeners know, and we know that, you know, people working in healthcare increasingly acknowledge the role of social determinants of health on access and outcomes, as well as the experience of receiving healthcare. And I think, you know, we've chatted about this sometimes on our podcast. It's hard sometimes for institutions to know how they can address social determinants of health that are upstream from what's bringing the patient into the hospital sometimes. So one thing you've been focused on are these medical legal partnerships. And I understand they've been around about 20 years, but I had not heard about them until the last few months. So can you explain to us, you know, what they are and what they're designed to do?
Yeah, no, I think that's really interesting to know, just from someone who's kind of worked in it. It's not to know that it's not as, you know, there's not as much awareness about this great tool than there should be. So I think it's really interesting to kind of just take a step back and realize, you know, in having a background both in law and bioethics has really created an interesting ability to either marry the two or sort of have very, very differing perspectives, right, in certain situations. And, you know, we tend to think of when you work in healthcare, there might be some hesitance towards legal professionals and vice versa. So there's some a lot of times there's some antagonism and some tension there. But what's wonderful about medical legal partnerships is it really centers on this synergy between medicine and law, where you can actually work together in order to achieve sort of a common goal of like health equity and just overall optimal health outcomes. And so I think it really underscores that opportunity in the first instance. I think what's really great also about medical legal partnerships is that you're right, they started, I would say, probably in the 90s. And it's funny to think about the 90s. Sometimes you think, wow, that was only 20 years ago, 30. But, you know, it's relatively young, even though, you know, 30, 40 years ago, maybe relatively in its infancy, if we want to think about models of care and partnerships in that traditional sense. So yes, relatively recently, and basically started, the beginnings were the usual formula tip, or I wouldn't say usual, but I would say that the traditional formula would be you have to have a medical champion, right? So somebody in the healthcare network or healthcare system really saying, this is a problem, we need to do something about it, and then take it from A to B seamlessly in a way. And working within the framework of healthcare, I think, is a big part of this puzzle. If you want to think about medical legal partnerships, aside from both entities being, you know, working together in concert, what ends up happening is that lawyers are really become specialists in healthcare, and they're embedded in the healthcare framework itself. So when there's some problem or health harming, unmet legal needs that's been screened for, and I'll explain and define what all of those terms mean. But let's just take an example, loss of employment as a result of a health, some sort of illness or disorder that someone has that now, you know, we all know that health insurance is linked to employment. So there's some cascading impacts there as a result. I think all of these things kind of play into what a lawyer can do. And rather than being referred external to the healthcare appointment, the person is actually, the lawyer is actually embedded in the healthcare plan, so that it becomes, like you said, an upstream access to justice or care and health services. So I think what to underscore would be that there's this sort of common goal in both missions, right? So healthcare system, obviously, you want to do no harm, but you also want to have, you know, help and mitigate against some risk, or at least improve some sort of circumstances that lead to overall health for the patient client. So I think there's a lot of overlapping goals here in what each one is hoping to achieve, an overall healthcare mission, which provides a really optimal collaborative atmosphere and environment to achieve overall health equity issues for patients.
So I do have a follow-up question, just to see if you have a little bit of knowledge in this area. I'm curious of how a medical legal partnerships, you said it's been around for around 20 years. I'm curious if you have any knowledge regarding how law and policy, if there's any impact on law and policy, either at the federal, state, or local levels, based out of these medical legal partnerships, because of course, the big elephant in the room, of course, the overturning of Roe versus Wade, many other different states' rights versus, you know, federal rights, all these different dynamics at the legal level that is deeply, intrinsically connected to medical practice, but also impacts millions upon millions of patients. I'm just curious if you have any knowledge in that particular area of how influential medical and medical legal partnerships are in that particular area.
Right. So I think it's really good to just acknowledge right here that law and policy can have both positive but also negative impacts on health. So I think that's the first point to kind of think about. And through that, when you look at it as sort of legal determinants of health, and there's lots of scholars who have written about this, how we can actually design laws that actually are, you know, counterproductive and counterintuitive to what, you know, our overall goals are in achieving health, optimal health outcomes, and how some of them are enforced unfairly or under-enforced, so on and so forth. So I think I'll give one example. I believe in like 2015, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid actually decided through accountable health community model that they would address sort of critical gaps in care. And this is like clinical care and sort of bridging that gap between community health and just acknowledging that there's a space here for community health services in the current framework of healthcare delivery, and issued, created opportunities here for entities to be able to create these relationships with community health services and workers to improve. And by doing this, I think it was pilot projects, and they were able to say, okay, well, you know, here's something you can test. And their overall question was really, how is this going to impact healthcare costs? So that was really back then, I think that was sort of their, and even to some extent now, they're really interested in healthcare costs. Is this sort of solving our crisis of soaring healthcare costs in a preventative sort of lens? And is this also similarly improving the overall health, not only of the individual, but sort of populations and particularly vulnerable populations? And also not only, you know, how do we define health? Are we thinking about quality of life? Are we just thinking about sort of metrics of like things like blood pressure and so on? So I think there are vehicles and mechanisms that have been tried throughout the course of this time. And I think there's been significant movement in accepting medical legal partnerships, as even though the evidence was slow to come on board, you know, to be able to provide this evidence that this is definitely something that we should invest in more to ascertain whether or not the impacts are actually effective or not, and to what degree.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a good segue into really looking at medical legal partnerships as a useful strategy to address, you know, the social determinants of health. And you did mention previously about medical cost. A further question is that with having negotiations with Medicare, for example, to a lower prescription drugs, is that like one particular dynamic within medical legal partnerships?
So I don't think that's something that's been raised as of yet, but, you know, one of the beautiful things about this area is that it's constantly evolving, and it's blossoming in different areas, ranging from a spectrum of domains. So what I want to just also make sure that we kind of talk about and discuss is about sort of the social determinants of health you raised just a while ago. And, you know, one thing medical legal partnerships are really good at is screening for some of these unmet legal needs. And what the research has shown is some of these unmet legal needs, for instance, if you're thinking about like child custody, you're having legal issues with estate planning or, you know, landlord-tenant disputes, employment disputes, this also can be classified as health-harming legal needs. And so the connection there is these legal issues are impacting your health either directly through stress and so on, but also indirectly through lack of access to proper healthcare that might be essential for that particular person. And by way of that mechanism, it's an upstream access to justice. So really, medical legal partnerships are really worried about these legal issues and why people are hesitating, or you don't access the medical care because you are very scared about either losing your job, because if you have an appointment to go to during work hours and your employer is not amenable to such things, then you are very scared about losing your job, which is a very reasonable thing to be scared of. And so in many ways, it can be considered personalized. It's very personalized. Everyone has, you know, could have unique legal issues specific to their cases. It's proactive, right? It doesn't, it's trying to react on the proactive and prevention side of the equation versus reacting, where you have to sort of solve the crisis on the other side of the equation. So I think the if you want to think of it like that, it's really heavy on how can we prevent sort of these cascading impacts that legal issues often engender and sort of catalyze because they are so inextricably linked to the person's health, I would say. And also, you know, some other examples would be health insurance. We're all, you know, we all know that employment and health insurance are just, you know, one and the other. And so full-time employment often guarantees as part of your compensation package, your health insurance, right? So you lose full-time employment, or some of those who don't have full-time employment and are part-time employed will see maybe they don't have healthcare coverage and as a result aren't able to access healthcare in very essential or medications that you know, add up after if you're paying out of pocket. So I want to come back to this definition of social determinants of health, which I think I'm glad you raised because it's so important. And just to sort of define it, it's the these are the conditions in which we live in, which you learn, you work, you play. They're just so inherently linked to our health and often are, like I mentioned before, created or influenced by laws and policies that often are inconsistent with the overarching goal of health promotion, and so on and so forth. And so I think if we are able to marry both of these areas where the lawyer is embedded in the healthcare environment and the healthcare framework, the thought is, okay, we will prevent, we will handle the legal issue and avoid the impacts that it would necessarily have in terms of access to care and hopefully secure. And this could be in a variety of areas and domains. Just to give you an example, a lot of times they're in pediatric fields where there's like a population of asthma individuals and, you know, there's interventions that are recommended by pediatricians, for instance, just removal of carpets in your houses and, you know, substandard housing, or there's mold, you know, so there's lots of things that could be impactful for the child in that circumstance. And, you know, it's preventable. I think that's really what's key. If you improve the housing quality, that is. Another area is individuals who have been incarcerated that are now reassimilating into a population or community, and they need help and assistance, finding a job, finding a place to live, those types of things. Persons who might have in palliative care situations might need more, or I would say in dementia care facilities or areas that have patients with progressive cognitive decline or dementia will require some sort of estate planning and those types of things where it's very complicated, but an extremely beautiful and enriching experience for both legal professionals involved in MLPs, but also healthcare professionals as well. And also areas where there's undocumented individuals that are either being exploited by their employers or in many cases there's labor disputes or housing disputes and becomes a compensation dilemma where they were not compensated or unfairly compensated. And so lots of areas that MLPs can be used in and can really help move health in the right direction for patients.
Well, thanks for those examples. So MLPs can support individual patients and families with those types of needs that you outlined, but I think they also can have a role. I mean, it'd be great if you can describe how they work with social workers and community health workers. There's some overlap there, but also how they can impact training, policy level solutions or address, you know, patterns that hospitals might be noting among their patients. So can you describe that for us?
Yeah, sure. I think I'll talk about training, I think, in the first part. I think what's really great about some of the MLPs that have begun is that not only do you have sort of this collaborative space between both areas, law and medicine, but you also have sort of the broader network of care as well, and which includes necessarily in many instances social workers, community health workers. And so you're really casting this wide web of healthcare professionals that are coming together to help solve whatever legal issues, whatever health issues that this particular client patient has. And so I think it really brings in that holistic viewpoint. Instead of us working in silos, we're in handoff to the next person. The second point is when you're one of the policy issues, and I should have probably, this is also sort of a footnote to that prior policy question, is one thing that was really significant, I think, is implementing the screening for social determinants of health and unmet legal needs in sort of electronic medical records. Small steps, but I think it acknowledges that, you know, social determinants of health are important for healthcare workers to sort of clue in and say, identify and acknowledge that these are very important parts of the healthcare plan and profile of my patient. So I think that was really significant as well. And training both legal professionals and healthcare professionals is just such a rich space too, because there's so much that I think us being on sort of the law side don't know about sort of the healthcare side. And I think being able to be attuned to some of the nuance that healthcare workers would be, you know, be in a position to advise and guide. I think that information sharing can often be confidential within the sort of, if you're thinking about HIPAA and, you know, data privacy and so on, but there are ways to work within the, you know, to be compliant with all of the legal standards, so that you are being able to information share in sort of a way that's really beneficial for your patient client. And, you know, I think it's really necessary to be able to identify those, right? And to be able to say, okay, this is part now, I'm acknowledging that part of my patient's healthcare is being impacted, or at least access to healthcare is being impacted by these other external circumstances, maybe not biologically related, but definitely impacting their health in a way by way of their lack of access to care. And by that, I mean the unmet legal issues that we talked about earlier, like labor disputes, employment disputes, landlord-tenant, any kind of legal dispute that might be arising as a result of their situation. And I will just say a large proportion of people who are living in what we would call the sort of the federal poverty level experience the most amount of unmet legal needs. And this is sort of where medical legal partnerships kind of have the most return of benefit, because we don't have a guarantee for having a person dedicated in this space. And I mean person, I mean a legal entity dedicated to help navigate this space for every individual that comes in below a certain, below the federal poverty level, does not have a guarantee. And sort of a parallel to that would be, you know, we guarantee legal aid or legal services like public defenders and so on and so forth in sort of the criminal law context, but we do not have such such a guarantee in this civil legal context. And so I think it's really important to try to underscore that while it's not guaranteed, we can provide it in different ways, and it is very important, as much research has shown as well.
So Lynette, can you outline some steps that you'd recommend that institutions might consider if they were planning to start
an MLP?
Yeah, sure. I think one of the things to realize is when you are contemplating starting an MLP, you really have to have a person in the healthcare network to actually take this across the finish line. So you not only have to have sort of the access to the legal resources, but you also have to have that medical champion who is saying, no, we need this. Many, many people, and I'll just give you an example, an oncologist that I know who noticed a lot of her breast cancer patients were just encountering real challenges in terms of difficulties at keeping their jobs because they were coming, they had to come for consecutive appointments, and that was not okay with their employer. And as a result, they were having to either let go or transferred to another area where their employment or their income was actually much less than it was before. And I think what was really, you know, she decided, like, this is consistently happening to all of her breast cancer patients, and more so than any other area that she was, you know, involved in. And so she basically said, I need to find a group of motivated lawyers or legal aid society that can help me with my patients because they cannot access the necessary and essential care that they need because of these other barriers that they're encountering, for instance, with their employer and having to. And of course, you know, the obvious cascading impact of that is that if they can't, if they're not employed, they'll lose their health insurance and cannot access their care as a result. So we think it's really important to have that medical champion who can say, you know, this is the population I see, this is what we're noticing, and sort of identify some of those legal, health-harming legal needs, right? So if you're seeing a population that is encountering some sort of child custody issues or silence and so forth, you will be able to identify. So I think that's the major thing here, because without it, I think that advocacy, it's going to be an uphill battle to kind of establish an MLP. Once you have that, I think identifying a source of funding will be the next step, obviously. Now, what's really critical here is to just know that most MLPs right now are sort of underfunded. They probably could use more streams and more consistent streams of revenue. It's a patchwork, essentially, and I think the National Center for Medical Legal Partnerships does a really great job of sort of parsing through some of the more nuanced mechanics of funding mechanisms, but I'll just say broadly, they can be sort of categorized into three areas of healthcare funding sources. So from your hospital line item budgets and operating budgets, legal funding sources, which would be from a law school. Typically, this involves a clinical or experiential learning clinic where in law school where you have either a law professor, a supervising attorney, or students, or all of the above, who are interacting or providing some legal solutions for these client patients. So that partnership can be also very exciting if you have a law school that's affiliated with your, or in if either with your institution or in the area, you might want to consider that. Or philanthropic sites and institutions, I think, are good streams of revenue as well. That are, you know, I want to say this is sort of an evolving area. People are becoming more creative and innovative with the funding streams, but also more advocacy. Every step of the way, there's evidence that's leading towards more advocacy. And I think that has taken another step in procuring more stable funding streams. So I know in the fiscal year for 2023, there was in the appropriations bill is something of $2 million secured for MLPs. And I believe it goes through HRSA, but I'll double check and confirm that. But I know that it's definitely in the budget, at least for fiscal year 2023. And I think in the third instance, you'd have to sort of think about like these memorandums of understanding. between the two entities and how you're going to allocate funding, budgets, those types of things, again, can be complex. And I think for listeners, if you are really keen on pursuing this, there's a wealth of resources through the National Center for Medical Legal Partnerships. They have Bethany Hamilton, who is there, who is an amazing resource as well. And it lists, I think, other contacts. I just want to footnote that and say, I think Bethany is still there. So I'd have to confirm, but as far as I know, I think she's still there. And I think for the memorandums of understanding, this is really sort of, it gets into, if you're in a hospital network, this is where your general counsel's office might come in. But if you're a smaller, like a private practice or something of that nature, I think the dynamics become a little bit different. But also partnering with a law firm that might be doing pro bono work, these are areas that could also be explored. There are lots of law firms that want to engage with this type of work. And if you sort of approach them and say, look, we really have a need for this, I think that might be something that they would be, you know, they also have a lot more resources than, say, a legal aid society would. And I think establishing those connections would probably be some of the first steps. But for more detailed, I think, step-by-step algorithmic, you know, how to proceed, I would say contact the National Center. They have a lot of material and knowledge and evidence and experience, and they'll be able to connect you with people who are potentially in the area who you might be able to partner with, or similarly, a network of individuals who might be able to guide you in the process and say, okay, this is what worked for us, since there is a lot of variability in how things are structured and funded and how they even started. I think that's kind of the gist of it.
Oh, well, thank you for that thorough response. Really appreciate the really nuts and bolts of MOPs. I do have a clarifying question in regards to funding. So usually do MOPs, how do they create their structure? Is it like more of a nonprofit structure or LLC corporate type of structure, or it just depends on the MOP and what their particular goals are?
Yeah, I think you kind of hit the nail on the head here. I think there's just wide variety and variability of how they're structured. It could be as formalized as an LLC. It could be as informal as just sort of a domain within a particular hospital. So less formalized, a little bit more, you know, I would say less, and all of this would be in your memorandum of understanding, because of course you have to have something articulated no matter how formal and or informal. So it depends on your resources to begin with, what type of leadership you have, what type of access to other resources you have. So do you have a legal aid society, for instance, that can partner with you? So I think it becomes all of those questions, and that really leads and informs how you're going to formulate your structure of your MLP, and also how you think about it, how it might, you know, be sustained. Because I think that's kind of the challenge in a lot of MLPs, that while they secure funding, if it's usually it could be something like a pilot project. So they have 1 or 2 years of funding, but then they can't really continue, or they have a lot of challenges sustaining their program through a number of years. And I think to sort of intuitively follow up on that, you can understand how it might be hard to establish evidence if you've only been running for a year or two, because oftentimes in pilot projects, you know, you get a year's worth of work, but then that leads to much bigger funding. If you have, you know, appealing evidence, I would say, you know, to suggest, okay, there's something there, we want to study it more, we need a little bit more in our budget to do so. So I think it really just depends. There's a lot. What's great about it being so flexible is that you know, because it's personalized care, certain populations, you might want to have a little bit more of a flexible structure, infrastructure or model versus a more formalized model that might actually be sort of a little bit counterproductive to being able to provide the care and services that you're looking to provide. I think as sort of a corollary to that, you really want to think about if you want to have a generalized MLP, right? So if you live in a population of just sort of a mix and multitude of different legal unmet legal needs, and you're not seeing it on the healthcare side as a healthcare practitioner in one particular population, right? So you're not seeing it in, like, you know, your elderly patients or your cancer patients. You're not. If you have a generalized one, you're going to want to just sort of, it might be slightly easier to start that in the first instance. And then if you see sort of, okay, we're having 10 patients who are experiencing, tenant landlord issues, and we want to get their housing that's substandard conditions improved, you're going to want to start to explore that. But I think that would probably be potentially something you might want to do after you've sort of given this general MLP a go in the first instance. But then, you know, if you are living in a population that's experiencing dire circumstances, like for instance, in the breast cancer population that I mentioned earlier, you might want to say, look, this is a very vulnerable population. And of course, most of these populations are in various different ways. But you want to sort of highlight that fact of why is this population being impacted, in what ways, and how can we, provide some interventions to ameliorate their circumstances, or in many ways just remove or prevent some of the cascading health impacts that might result from these unmet legal needs.
Yeah, no, yeah, absolutely. So it definitely depends on the MLP's mission, vision, and goals, and obviously what they're trying to accomplish, what they feel is important at the moment. Also, what evaluations do hospitals, go in their process to assess how the MLP is going and the impact it's having on patients or broader issues? And of course, that also depends on a hospital. If you're a rural hospital, you have different particular issues you're trying to resolve compared to an urban or more suburban hospital. What are your thoughts on hospital evaluations assessing MLPs?
So I will say there are some more formalized and, by formalized, I mean the infrastructure in order to be able to evaluate the efficacy of a particular project or MLP is much more formalized than others. So I think some projects could be, and I don't want to say to bypass the IRB approval, but to sort of, there are certain barriers that IRB approval provides and certain challenges, I think, that are can be sidestepped if you provide or engage in sort of a quality improvement project. And so many MLPs, what they end up doing is doing these quality improvement projects to assess, basically, are they being effective? How are they impacting health? And so on and so forth, different metrics used depending on whatever particular population they're, assessing. And so I think it's really, and I haven't looked into it recently about how this concept of privacy is being handled and, sort of in a sensitive and yet compliant way, because you're dealing with non-HIPAA institutions and, you know, the law side of things and sort of the healthcare side of things. So all of that to say, there is a lot of variability in how a lot of the efficacy and effectiveness has been assessed. And so you will have more sort of incorporated into sort of the electronic medical records, there might be some reporting that's saying, okay, you know, these past 100 days, we had X amount in sort of these different screening areas that might be collected on the on the sort of social determinants of health tab in sort of Epic or, you know, whatever electronic medical record you use in that hospital network. So it might be something simple as sort of a reporting mechanism, or it might be a little bit more complex. Some scholars have done this where you're sort of saying, well, we came in 1 year, we had X amount of patients who came in, pediatric patients who had asthma, we did this intervention, and as a result, you know, likely, because we, you know, can't say with some degree of certainty that it's very likely that because of this intervention, we had a decreased population that presented with asthma the following years. And so I think there's a robust group and network of scholars who are studying that aspect of MLPs right now. There are just a variety of domains, and I think really important to think about how confounding factors play into some of this. And also, I think there's a hesitance if you have a grant that what if you at the end of it achieve or you know, in your evaluation, you find out, wow, I actually didn't quote unquote help my patient. And I think it's really important to kind of understand what you're doing, what you're helping, because if you come in with, say, let's just say we administer a stress test in the very beginning and then sort of have over the course of time, we administer this and intermittently with the notion that, okay, the MLP is at least alleviating stress, you know, so there are different metrics that you can use as proxies for I think this sort of overarching idea of helping the patient. And I think the hesitance there often is, what if I don't get a quote unquote positive impact result or a positive outcome from this intervention? Will I have my grant money? Will I not get, you know, renewed grant money? And I think there's that contemplation as well in all of the MLP space where, you know, there is that fear. And I think we can overcome that if we had more guaranteed streams of revenue. So I think that's also speaks to sort of the funding and evaluation as well.
Yeah, I can imagine that even though you might feel that your intervention had really helped so many people, maybe, you know, demonstrating the evidence could be tricky if it was, as you say, just a 1 year grant or something. Well, thank you so much for being here. And I think this is amazing and I wish more people knew about it. And we will definitely be linking up to on our website, linking up to the National Center for Medical Legal Partnerships and posting those resources. And we really appreciate you being here today.
Thank you for listening to another great conversation on bioethics in the margins. This podcast is hosted by Amelia Barwise and Kirk Johnson. Our producer is Elizabeth Chung. Our editor is Madeline Mahoney. Our theme music was written and produced by Pablo Cortes. We are grateful for the assistance of Wendy Jung, and Gargi Pandey is our creative director. Nicole Strand is our advisor, and Steven Sodecki is our senior advisor. Join us again next time.